How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World is a new book by Henry Mantz. Henry's the chief features writer for the Financial Times, and he pens a weekly satirical column on politics and culture as well. He's talked about UK politics in the past on RNZ. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning.
Love is the extremely difficult realization that something other than oneself is real. Love is the discovery of reality, Iris Murdoch. And your book starts with that quote. I seem to remember an interview with her once in The Independent over lunch, which included cold meats and cheese. Now, none of us is perfect in this respect, Henry.
Absolutely not. I think Iris Murdoch was friends with some people who were very interested in animal interest and animal rights, but I don't think she went for it herself, and I don't think her letters show much of an attention. And it's interesting. I think lots of us have blind spots. You know, you can't show compassion everywhere. You can't be across every issue. But I love that idea of Iris Murdoch, which is, you know, it's often we look at things and we think they're beautiful, and we, you know, whether they're pet dogs or, you know, parrots outside or whatever it might be. And then there's a next step that I think we have to take, which is to ask, well, what can we do to pay back that appreciation? What can we do to recognize the living being behind that lovely dog face or that lovely parrot face? How can we make the world a slightly better place for them? And that's kind of what this book is about.
Yes, it is what this book's about, which accounts for its charm. And it has a grand first line of yours. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by cat videos. And it's a fantastic line. But most of us don't eat cats, although cats are eaten still in the world, aren't they?
Well, I'm not sure about that. Certainly not in my household. But they may be. And there is a sort of challenge of you know, why do we live in a world where we kill 80 billion livestock animals and maybe a trillion or so fish every year quite happily, but we would never dream, at least in many rich countries, of eating our pets, even after they've died of natural causes, and they would be the most sustainable meat out there. Yeah. And I think that gets us into a discussion around, we want to recognize the beauty of that personality. We see personalities in our cats and our dogs. There are people who love rats and snakes and would say that they have lovely personalities. And if we can recognize that with some of our pets, can we recognize that with some of our farm animals and recognize maybe that the farming system doesn't work particularly well for them?
Yes, I mean, yours is a lyrical sort of book, but it's also lacerating, if that's the right word, regarding some of our practices with farming. So I'll get on to that. You say, vis-a-vis of what you've already said in the chat, actually, our relationship with animals is fraught with contradictions. We contain all sorts of contradictions. And it always has been. We eat pigs, which are every bit as smart as dogs in some respect. Some people eat dogs as well. Little lambs are adorable, and then we make them into chops. We lavish attention on endangered birds. You mention kia in New Zealand because of their smartness. We almost treat some animals and birds as sacred objects, but we keep chickens in dark cages. So we're able to hold all these contradictions in our heads most of the time. So for you, when did that stop, that ability to hold the contradiction in your head? I know you began this book as a vegetarian and now you're a vegan.
I am. If you'd said to me a few years ago that I would be a vegan, I would have sort of thought it was very extreme. My wife described it as a divorceable step. For me, one really key moment was the birth of my kids and seeing how they kind of brought animals back into the household. Suddenly you have storybooks, you have teddies, you know, soft toys, got cartoons on the TV, and all of them are representations of animals. And you realize that you're bringing your kids up to think that animals are the most wonderful, beautiful things, and that they have this kind of almost sacred place in our society, which is kind of true, except there's another side of it, which is some of the animals that they're surrounded about in their storybooks. Or, you know, my daughter had a Sophie the giraffe, which is a rubber giraffe, which you can suck. Giraffe numbers have fallen in the wild really significantly over my lifetime. And so I felt that I was surrounding them with a contradiction. You know, I love animals, I find them beautiful. I was into photography for a long time. And I suddenly thought, well, hold on, what am I doing to repay all that beauty? And so it's been a gradual process of exploration. And I don't claim to have all the answers, but I really think that if more people did that, they would change the way they eat. They would change the way they live.
Do you have a sweetness of temper now? I found that phrase in your book. You were looking back at the surprisingly long history of animal activism. Do you have a sweetness of temper as a vegetarian? Are you somehow a bit less aggressive, more attuned to the planet than hitherto?
Jim, you're very kind to bring that one up rather than, I think, the other thing that was thrown at vegetarians in the 19th century, which was sexual impotence. So I thank you of your choice of question. I feel it's been much less of a change to me and to my personality. And, a lot of people say they feel healthier after giving up meat. Some people say they're desperate to eat a particular thing, like bacon or cheese. I haven't really had that. I think if you eat good food, anyone who's played football with me would not say that I've have a sweetness of temper, but nor have I found it a sort of debilitating thing to give up meat and dairy.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a bit like giving up smoking in a way. Some people say, oh, I craved forever. And some people say, no, I actually didn't notice any difference. It's not actually like giving up smoking, but it's interesting how...
Well, no, I think that's a really interesting comparison. I mean, even at its height, smoking, I touch on it in the book. It's sort of, maybe 60% of adults smoke. I mean, we live in societies where 95% of people eat meat in most Western countries. So to opt out of that does involve a few conversations. But if you go around to someone's house for dinner and they say, oh, you got any requirements? And you say, I don't eat meat and dairy. I have never really found it a problem.
Quoting you, we might fancy the life of a dog in modern day America, lazing on the sofa with organic biscuits and a whimsical Instagram account. But if we were randomly reincarnated, we'd be at least 20 times more likely to end up as factory chickens. Only if we'd been bad, Henry, surely. I suppose it depends on what kind of reincarnation is subscribed to here.
Yeah, exactly. I try and leave the book open to all comers, really. But, the rise of chicken is... incredible. I mean, really, 100 years ago, chickens were not really farmed for meat. Almost by accident in Delaware, a woman seems to have discovered that you could keep chickens for meat, breed them, and then, all the developments of factory farming, which means that really, maybe 70% of birds on the planet are chickens. And it is the most eaten meat in most Western countries. And we don't really stop to think, hold on, these are birds who were involved for a completely different environment, a completely different social arrangement. They're not dumb. They're adapted to a forest environment. They're jungle fowl. We keep them together and they live pretty poor lives. Yeah. And very short lives, really. I mean, sort of often a month and a half or so before they're killed, and the strain on their body, on their bones. And so yeah, I wouldn't fancy my chances if I was randomly reincarnated, and I wouldn't want to end up as a farm chicken. And even the sort of adjustments we try and make with organic and free range and furnished cages and whatever else, it really can't get over the fact that we've bred these animals into shapes which are fundamentally unhealthy, because that's how industrialized farming works.
Yes, the rise of the chicken, if you can call it a rise, has been exactly like that. We used to have a chook at Christmas time when I was a small boy, and it was... a grown fowl, and it was a treat. And we had staples in our meat diet like tripe and lamb's fry, which probably most families don't have today. It has all changed because of the chicken. But speaking of offal and such, while you were researching this book, you worked in an abattoir and in a place where they breed pigs. And Paul McCartney in your book, or once a quote from him in your book, once said, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everyone would be a vegetarian. What emotional residue was there from those jobs that you took and experienced?
Yeah, I really wanted to go and see it with my own eyes. And I wanted to not just write about industries from the outside and sort of write them off as right or wrong, really, but to sort of experience it and to understand what part they play in our society. I mean, my first emotion was kind of shock, because I turned up at this abattoir just outside of London, and said, oh, I quite fancy a job. I wasn't even asked my surname, and I was just shown onto the production line. They said the training would be required, but it turned out just to be a pair of boots and an overall. And I was there sort of dismantling sheep. And I suddenly realized, wow, this is a job that not many people want. In Britain, it's mostly EU migrants who do the work. And it's a job that is pretty grueling, pretty hard. And if you obviously, if you don't pay attention to your fingers, you might lose one of them. And I think what I really saw was our power. And I think the emotion was a kind of responsibility that here was a facility with not particularly advanced technology, but with obviously sharp blades and knives and a few workers. And it was sucking in hundreds of sentient mammals a day. I suddenly thought, well, hold on, if we're going to do this, if we're going to kill this many animals, can we at least check that this is what we want to do, that this is sustainable, that this fits with our value of loving animals? And then when I went to the pig farm, what I saw were kind of very constrained, unnatural lives, which didn't have the things that make life valuable. I mean, I think as humans, we can't really tell whether a lot of other animals are happy. And I think one of the things we have to therefore rely on is, do animals have the ability to take choices over their own lives? Do they have the ability to, spend time with other animals that they want to spend time with, to move freely across the natural world? And on a pig farm, even a pretty decent pig farm, I didn't feel that was the case. You know, artificial insemination, death at a time of our choosing, constrained in pens in a time of our choosing. I found it was run by good people who wanted to provide a service to society, but I didn't feel comfortable getting meat from there.
But you say somewhere in the book that a human life is worth more than a pig's life. And I suppose the general riposte from people who don't agree with you regarding some of the things you say is, weren't we always omnivores? Those choices, we've taken those choices, actually, and we've done it for an awfully long time.
My first reaction to that is, our ancestors certainly ate meat, but they didn't eat anything like the amount of meat that we eat today.
Yeah.
And we eat in rich countries far more protein than we need to. We can't justify it as necessary, I think, if in some European countries we're eating double the recommended allowance of protein. And when there are, in any case, plant-based alternatives, our love for animals, whether it be through cat videos or through pets or going on a safari or trying to protect the kia, that is really one of our values. It's why politicians pose with pets, because they know that that sort of is a symbol of being a good person.
Yeah.
And I think if we therefore extend that to the whole range of animals, we will change. It's harder when there are arguably impacts we have that are necessary. So, a medical testing, when you can have real benefits to human life, then that is a much harder equation. But with food, we don't need animal protein. We have alternatives.
How to love animals in a human-shaped world. Henry Mance is talking to us. And because your book covers so much territory, I don't want to be bogged down in debates about, the nutrition we can get from meat that we can't get from anywhere else. But I think we all take your point about whether we're eating just far too much of it. China, keeping with pigs for a moment, China gets enough bad press right now for its human rights practices, but you alert us to how pigs are housed in China in hog hotels.
Yeah, I mean, in China, which is a huge pork-eating country, the traditional way was a couple of pigs in the backyard, and they're now on a trajectory of industrialization and doing things that I think in Britain we regard as pretty unethical. Keeping pigs in multi-story farms, slatted floors, obviously, but zero contact with the natural world, no ability to see the soil, which obviously pigs love to root around in. If you think of a wild boar sort of running through the forest, the type of environment that a pig might enjoy, and obviously the social relationships they want to keep and to make. And, intensive pig farms, which we have in lots of countries, but which I think are hopefully being phased out, and big companies saying that they'll go cage-free, that they won't keep pigs for months on end in these crates, metal crates that they can't turn round in. It's sad to see that countries like China are adopting those habits and in some ways doing it into a more intensive and a more restrictive way.
Yes, and certainly pigs in crates and poultry in cages and pigs in hog hotels. But just going back to that phrase you used about taking choices in their own lives, does that assessment depend on how many decisions you think animals make and the sorts of relationships they form? And you do provide some splendid examples of animal conviviality and seeming animal caring and intelligence. But does it extend, for example, to cows and sheep?
Yeah, I mean, cows, if you walk in the countryside and you see cows engaging in social behavior, now, you know, not just eating, not just being milked, but running or butting heads or, you know, nosing, whatever it might be. And you suddenly realize, oh, hold on, these are not just sort of meat robots, or they're not crops. You know, these are sentient beings. And there's a book from many years ago called The Secret Life of Cows by, I think, by Rosamund Young, which talks about her relationship with her herd and seeing all the different personalities in it. And I think, yeah, those animals are not fundamentally different because we eat them. Because we eat animals, we kind of underestimate their mental abilities. And I feel that, that there is a real turning point with animals, partly because of social media exposing us to so many beautiful images of animals. You know, and you can if you doubt the ability of cows to enjoy the natural world and form relationships, you Google a few videos from farm rescues and you'll see that these are animals with real personality.
Yes, you have elephants grieving and orcas parenting way beyond instinctual care of their young, seemingly. You've got the interesting mood changes in pigs when their environments are nice. Fish get stressed. And, of course, we don't want to, many of us, to be thinking about this all the time with our meat-eating habits. I mean, you'll be telling us that houseflies are just being affectionate when they land on us soon, Henry. It's a joke.
There is there are limits. You know, the book is subtitled In a Human-Shaped World. There's a religion called Jainism where people whose adherents tried very hard not to inflict violence on living beings. And this effectively means they can't travel because of the insects that might be squashed on the windscreen. And I think that becomes pretty debilitating. You know, we should feel... I actually did manage to meet a couple of Jains in London because they've been given special permission to fly. But I think, you know, we can only do things within limits. And actually there is some evidence that flies can feel pain, but I think the implication of that is more in medical research where they're used almost like iron filings, and that maybe, you know, fruit flies could be treated a little bit better, but if there's no, especially if there's no cost involved to us.
Cherish the fruit fly. Okay. It would not be a popular argument in many parts of New Zealand that we don't need cow's milk, especially for children. I'm not saying a lot of people don't agree with you, but that would be regarded, I think, especially by our economists, as maybe a step too far. You're quite down on cow's milk, aren't you?
If you become vegetarian, you end up eating more cheese than ever before because it's the thing on the menu. You know, it's the thing you know how to cook. You have lasagna, you have all these things, and the meat itself is quite easy to cut out if you replace it with cheese. But when I spoke to people, they said, look, the systems around dairy cows just haven't kept pace with actually some of the realities of beef farming. I mean, beef farming, at least in many farms, many systems, has paid attention to animal welfare pretty well over the last couple of decades. And if you were going to be a farm animal, you'd probably want to be a pasture-fed beef cow. I think dairy hasn't entirely kept pace in parts of the world with that. And there hasn't been the pressure and the attention and the realization that breeding puts a huge strain on the animal. I don't want this to become a sort of culture war book about, you know, whether you agree with the farming industry. And, you know, farmers, I found, are wonderful people, and they're trying to meet a real demand that's out there. I think there is a sort of consensus that we need to cut down on meat, if for nothing else, for climate reasons. Even if you don't come all the whole way on the journey with me to giving up milk and giving up meat, I hope that I can convince you that there is a middle step whereby we don't keep expanding. And, you know, the rising appetites around the world mean that we have this fundamental incompatibility with the amount of land we have and all the things we want to use it for over the next 20, 30 years. Something has to give. And I would say the easiest thing to give at the moment is our appetite. We can switch onto other products.
Yes. And as I said earlier, I don't want to arm wrestle, you know, with those traditional arguments with you about the value of milk and cheese and so on necessarily. But I should say, actually, that cheese, we heard recently on this show that cheese may be surprisingly good for mental health. Cheese was shown to be the most protective food against age-related cognitive problems. And weekly consumption of lamb, but not other red meats, was shown to improve long-term cognitive prowess. This was university analysis of people from the UK Biobank. But, I mean, the jury is not entirely in, is it?
No, and I think I'm very careful to not in the book to make health claims. This is not a book saying that veganism will make your life healthier. I think, you know, the evidence we have is that a vegan diet, a vegetarian diet, is eminently doable and suitable for people, whether they're athletes or pregnant women or ordinary adults. But you have to, whatever your diet, whether you eat meat, whether you eat vegetables mainly, you have to plan well and eat well. And I think there's a whole other discussion about why our diet's so poor, why we eat so many processed foods. I'd love us to get back to eating more seasonal foods. I believe that a vegetarian vegan diet is compatible with that, but I don't believe it's the answer in itself. You can eat unhealthy vegan food.
The world may well be turning in the way that you think it might be and in the way that you think it needs to. I suppose there'll be people listening who'll keep on eating meat regardless, and they'll just feel a bit awkward. You know, one day the sheep maybe driving us and trucks to the abattoir, but as George Orwell observed, the pigs became like the humans when they were allowed to. Can't we just say that cruelty is one of the ways the world, that makes the world turn round? I mean, acknowledge that and get on with a harsh reality without being consumed entirely by guilt, you know, when consuming a chicken leg.
A few years ago, I took a boat trip in off the northeast of England, and we went to see puffins. And puffins are beautiful birds. They're kind of actually much less graceful than you think. And they were flying out, and they were getting sand eels and then flying back to their nests, their sort of burrows. And they were beautiful, and I took lots of photos. Then we went back in the boat, and there was a little kid there, probably around 7 or 8. And he said to his parents, he sort of sat there silently, and then he said to his parents, "I love the puffins." And I thought, I love the puffins too, but what have I done for them? How have I made their life any better? I've come and seen them, taken photos, but, you know, those puffins are threatened by overfishing and various other things. And, I, you know, what's the imprint of my life on all these animals that I appreciate? And I think that there are many millions of people who watch wildlife documentaries, who watch cat videos, who have pets, who have just simply seen frogs or snakes or birds when they're out on a walk and thought, that's cool. And I would just try and get them to ask the same question of, what can you do in your life that makes that sentient life, that makes those creatures have a place on this planet?
Yeah.
Because right now we are, unfortunately, finding fewer and fewer niches for them. And so, yeah, I you know, nature is cruel, but we can be compassionate and we can also do ourselves a favor by protecting the animals we love.
Consumption of meat and milk is predicted to grow faster in the next 3 decades than in the past 5. By 2035, global demand for meat will be 400 million metric tons, more than the weight of all humans on Earth. That's in your book. And meat eating is declining in many advanced countries, but it's surging in Asia and Africa. I like the way you've rehabilitated the scorned word anthropomorphize. It's more apt than we've given it credit for in recent years, you say.
Yeah, I remember, and I'm sure other people have had the same experience. When you went to see Disney films, you know, a parent or an adult or just an older kid would say, oh, but they're just anthropomorphizing a mouse or, you know, a clownfish or whatever it might be. And, you know, you can't really take that seriously. And actually, scientists, really starting with Charles Darwin himself, you know, they realize that animals do have emotions. And if in doubt, and in many cases we are in doubt about what they feel and what their social lives might be like, but with the few basics, it does actually help to think about life in their terms. I mean, I think about elephants in zoos. Elephants are social animals. They live in herds. When there's a grandmother in the herd, the infant mortality rate of the young calves is lower because the grandmothers help with the parenting. Then what we do is we put them in zoos where we say, right, you're going to live with these three elephants for the rest of your life, even though you might be used to a herd which is always changing. And just and then one day we're just going to whip out one of the elephants and you'll never see them again. And I think if we anthropomorphize that and think, how would we feel being thrown in a house for the rest of our lives with three people that we've never met, and then suddenly one of them's disappeared? I think we would find it pretty uncomfortable, and we would feel sadness and grief and anger, and we would get aggressive like some of these animals get aggressive in zoos. And so I think it's a blunt tool, anthropomorphizing animals, but it can get us halfway, I think, to some answers.
Yeah, and you acknowledge that the answers aren't easy. You talk about the philosophical collision as animal protectors come up against protectors of the environment, and you give, as an example, the end of a wild horse culling practice in Australia, which then saw 20% of the horses starving to death instead. So, and you outline the ecological catastrophes on the way unless we mend our ways. An obvious example being the precipitous decline in insect numbers, especially where you are up in Europe, thanks to farming and pesticides. And it may also be the case, Henry, that there are just too many humans now. And 500 million people on the planet is a solution that you evaluate.
I should immediately say that I don't agree with it.
No, you don't espouse it.
I think there are lots of proposals flying around in this world of conservationists and people who care about animals, which are, a bit misanthropic, but also totally unrealistic. And, there are people who don't believe, who almost want to remove death from the animal world. There are instances where we need to cull wild animal populations, invasive species, deer in North America and in Europe, wild boar. They don't have the natural predators, so they will otherwise crowd out many other animals unless we intervene. And so there's a case for intervening there, and I try and be pragmatic. And I also try and, I think there are some people who care about animals who think, well, the simplest thing is just to have fewer humans and then we'd cut down fewer rainforests and fewer grasslands. And I think that misses the point slightly, which is that you can love humans and love animals. I think the modern world is great. I don't love cats more than I love humans. I like my cat very much, but I don't want humans to be wiped off the planet. And I also think that the thing I fundamentally recognize with animals is that they want to build families and they want to have social relationships. And that's why the separation of a dairy cow and calf is a painful one. And so it would be a bit senseless to say, right, no one on the world can reproduce because we've got to get our numbers down. I mean, we'd just be doing to humans what I don't want to do to dairy cows.
Couple more things. When you use the phrase "they want" regarding animals, and people might think, oh no, it's instinctual. But fish feel pain. At least the experiments you mention in the book suggest that. Goldfish will avoid an area of a tank where they have received electric shocks. Found that interesting. You're not that fond of fish farming. Although, is that preferable to the slaughter in the oceans? You're not sure.
I think on many of these things, one is worse on one measure and the other is worse on the other measure. I mean, fish farming, in some ways, it can be seen as more sustainable. If, for example, you could feed fish algae, which could be grown sustainably. And then, with taking fish from the wild, I think those fish have natural lives in the wild, but they can be killed in very inhumane ways, often dragged in trawler nets for hours. Numbers are nowhere near where they used to be for fish stocks, and a good minority of fish stocks are being exploited beyond capacity. So there are lots of tricky things. And I think the simplest thing is to go for those things for those solutions which are most sustainable. So you can eat mussels or farmed clams, which can be grown on ropes and which don't feel pain, probably. And we can eat more legumes and other vegetables, which are protein rich but require less land than livestock.
There's a lot of interest in your book interesting information that, like, the drugs industry in South America may have been a godsend for the environment, at least. Or if the 10,000 richest people on Earth put most of their wealth and influence into saving wildness, the world could change overnight. But my last question is to do with an aspect of what we can do. Is setting aside half of the world's surface for conservation fanciful? Because you raised this idea. And I once interviewed a rich bloke who had flown across vast swathes of the planet by helicopter and plane, and he said actually a lot of it looked pretty empty. Do you reckon we could do it in theory, have half the world absolute conservation territory?
At the moment, we're just below 20% of the land, and below 10% of oceans have some form of protection. And some of that is pretty loosely protected. You're allowed to fish in it. You're allowed to farm sheep in national parks in England. 50% is put out there as perhaps a ballpark figure for what you would need to really reduce many of the extinctions and the loss of animal life which we're facing. And, you know, a million species are estimated to be at risk of extinction at the moment. I think we could if we changed how we use land. At the moment, we use huge amounts of our land for agriculture and we use it inefficiently. When you fly over pasture lands, yes, they look empty, but they're being used to feed livestock. And that livestock is becoming an ever greater share of the animal life on this planet. And so if we cut back radically on the amount of meat we eat, then we would have wild spaces that we could allow wild animals to populate. And that would also lead to more resilient environment, trees doing their job in controlling floods, in storing carbon. And I think it's something worth aiming for. We have to pay poor countries to protect their rainforests, otherwise they'll cut them down, that's for sure. And these are huge issues. But I don't think with the climate change we're facing, and indeed just with the finite amount of land, as Mark Twain said, buy land, they're not making any more of it. And we have to think about, do we want to use it for more and more farms, or do we want to protect the wild animals that are at risk of extinction?
Very nice to chat with you, Henry. Thanks for giving us so much of your time today, too.
Thanks so much. It's been an absolute pleasure, Jim.
How to love animals in a human-shaped world. And we've been talking with Henry Mance.